Good morning. Thanks for coming, everybody. My name is John Jensen. Some of you, many of you were here yesterday, and I appreciate your coming back again. For those folks who are new, I teach at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Teach philosophy and environmental studies there. We had some fun yesterday with some case studies related to environmental ethics, and today I want to focus us a little bit more specifically on wilderness. I'll say much more about this as we go through, but I want to be clear that from my interest here and what we're doing today, there's a distinction between wilderness as an idea or as a concept, where when we say that Jesus went into the wilderness for 40 days, or when we're saying that sort of seems like a very wild place, we have something in mind in terms of what that means, which is related to, but is also separate from, wilderness as, in the United States anyway, a land management designation. So if you, there's a few seats up in the front row, so if you don't mind sliding through and around, you can come on up. When we say that if I hike out the valley a little ways, I cross a sign that says I am entering the Glacier Peak Wilderness, that has a very specific legal definition that goes along with it that has played an important part, designation as wilderness, in the history of the environmental movement in the United States and in terms of land management from there, that we have a huge amount of designated wilderness. And we'll talk a little bit about both of them and also about the connection between them as we go forward today. But we'll talk about both because I think both are really important and interesting for what we're doing here. I wanted to do just a couple of things in sort of follow-up to yesterday, but if you weren't here yesterday, I don't think it will matter that much. We talked a lot about a bunch of cases yesterday, some hypothetical sort of cases related to environmental ethics, and that ethics oftentimes sort of comes out of looking at scenarios and trying to say, all right, what would I do in this case? Because ultimately, ethics is about making decisions. But I want to be clear, that's not all that it is. And from my point of view, there's this connection between looking at a particular case. Oftentimes what we're trying to get is our sense of what our intuition of what we would do. What's my gut reaction of what would I do in that case? And then trying to say why. So we're looking at individual cases that I think of as, in practice, what would I do if this happened to me from there. And ultimately we're interested in moving beyond that, hopefully, to a realm where we come up with something that's a little bit more of a theory. So ethics should not be simply looking at individual decisions, but hopefully we've got a certain consistency to that. That I don't decide one thing in one case and something totally different in another case. That part of what it means to be a human being that is acting ethically is there's a certain consistency to my behavior over time. But ultimately, in looking at this relationship between the theory, there can be sort of a back and forth between these. I might have a theory that says, ultimately, I live my life according to the biblical mandates. But what does that mean when I look at individual cases? In some cases, how do I play that out? How does it go back and forth from there? So that hopefully there is this kind of back and forth that gives us this larger consistency, but also allows us to make decisions in individual cases from there. And then it gives us this little better sense of the bigger picture from there. And so the idea of starting with cases ultimately is one way to build us towards that kind of larger, more consistent framework from there. And so we'll again be in cases a little bit, but also trying to understand a little bit of that larger framework that's there. A set of questions for us for today. Why preserve wilderness is the big one. How do we understand what's going on from there? I'm interested in the conceptual question of how do we see ourselves as humans in relation to nature or the environment or creation, depending on how we want to describe it. Where do we fit in? And we talked about that yesterday, and this comes up very much in thinking about wilderness. What should be the role of wilderness in managing public lands? Should we have more wilderness on our public lands? Should we have less? Some of the most contentious issues in the West are about designation of wilderness over time, and not just in the West. The fights over the creation of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, for those of you that are from the Midwest up there, our closest designated wilderness area, were huge. And that's a very interesting case study of the making of environmental policy. The public fights, but also the private stuff. It literally is a case of smoky back rooms and drawing lines on maps of what would be included in the wilderness and what wouldn't from there. Do we need more wilderness? Is this something that should be a goal in managing our public lands? And then getting into criticisms of wilderness from there. And we'll talk more about this when we get to it. But does wilderness ultimately reinforce the separation between humans and nature? Nature is out there. It's those wild peaks that are out there where we live as civilization, and ultimately is that separation. And does wilderness make us dismissive or less likely to value the places where we live or of areas that are less wild from there? We'll get to those as we move forward from there. What I want to start with is a more particular question that has to do with Holden Village. And I want to ask this broad question, and I'll give you a little bit of context. Could we have Holden Village somewhere else? How closely tied is the experience of Holden Village? Is this sort of incredible thing that people come large distances from to this particular place in the Railroad Creek Valley, really surrounded by wilderness? I get up in the morning and I step out the door. The first thing I see is this amazing mountain peak that's rising up in front of me. We're tucked into this valley. We're separated out very much from civilization. We're in the middle of the wilderness. We were talking about students before that I bring up here in January being totally separated out from technology. Paul Rohde last night in a wonderful message talking about how the river empties us. We come into the wilderness from there. Could we have a similar experience? Could Holden Village really exist somewhere else? And I want to provide just a little bit of context because this is a question that was asked a lot at this place in the last several years. I first came to Holden Village in 2009. Many of you have been coming here for many years. And so the whole time that I have been here, there have been conversations related to the mine remediation. And when I first came here, there was a lot of conversation about what happens during the remediation and a lot of conversation about having Holden on the road. Couldn't we take Holden Village to other places? So during the 2 years or 3 years, or for a while they were talking about 5 years of no guests at Holden. How does Holden survive that? One of the things we were talking about is taking Holden on the road. And think about it with me for just a minute. If we think about what makes Holden special, what are the ingredients, if you will, that brings it all together? There are many things, but certainly central to that is the experience of community, the community among the staff, the community that sort of happens as we come here from there. Again, Paul Rohde talking about last night, there's this sense that it's a retreat. We've sort of stepped back from our daily lives, etc., from there. It's worship. The daily vespers that happens year round. Not just in the VC. When we're here in January and there's only 50 people here, it's still Vespers every day as that part of the worship that takes place in Koinonia Fireside. That's an essential element to what Holden Village is that we're there. There's a sense in which it's always an area of study as well. You're here in these classes. Some of you taking in all the classes you can get, some people out hiking, etc. from there. There's this sense that there is that is fun, that's a part of that along the way. You know, people talk about Holden hilarity, and this comes out at different times. And just this sense that you're doing things together from there. And then there is this piece that is the natural setting that is here, that is the wilderness. What happens if we take this one out? And we say, we're going to do Holden on the road. There were conversations to say, couldn't we have Holden Village Weeks at Lutheran College campuses across the country that would attract people coming in? You know, couldn't we have a week that takes in all of these dimensions, that brings Holden Village staff, that brings the teaching staff to do it at different places from there, at Decorah, Iowa, or Moorhead, Minnesota, or Thousand Oaks, California, in different places from there? What I'd like you to do, just for a couple of minutes with a partner or someone that's sitting next to you, and then we'll open up that conversation. Could we have Holden on the road? Could we have the experience of Holden Village in places other than the Railroad Creek Valley? What do you think? I'd like you to talk it through with one or two people that are around you just for a couple of minutes, then we'll open up that conversation. How important is the wilderness for this? Let's bring it back together as a large group, if we could, please. This, I suspect, is a question we could spend a couple hours on if we wanted to, and I'd like to hear a little bit of it, but also take us into some other stuff related to wilderness.
We felt that you left out one important ingredient in your list there, and
okay.
That was the sense of isolation, the remote, the warmth, sort of wilderness. And you could possibly go to a different kind of wilderness and have it succeed, but a college campus, we didn't feel a college campus would work.
Okay. Could we, let me just tweak it a little bit to see if this helps or not. And thinking about my own neck of the woods, in southeastern Minnesota is a place called the Eagle Bluff Environmental Learning Center, which definitely has a sense of isolation. Not far from Lanesboro, Minnesota, but also has a feeling of kind of being up in the woods. You look out over the Root River Valley from there. It doesn't feel like you are in civilization, but it's 2 hours from the Twin Cities, and definitely is not a wilderness by any means.
Cell phone, so.
Can you drive there?
You can drive there.
Can you drive away for the day and come back? That's what Runes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think you could arrange things to make that happen.
Throw your keys. I think a college campus wouldn't do it, but someplace like, Awani Lodge in Yosemite,
yep.
Where you are virtually the same. I mean, your lodge, there's the outdoor there, but you're still in cell phone. You can still drive away. Your car is still in the parking lot with your iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the question is, would the community be willing to make that commitment that, okay, the car, that's where the cell phone stays. We don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
This is, and would that make that community, in fact, perhaps more cohesive,
mm-hmm.
in that we are all volunteers. We're not forced to do this by the 2-hour ride from wherever we came on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
We are forced to do this because we are choosing to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the hair shirt thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep.
Well, one way to do that is do it on some sort of a cruise ship. You know, cross 200 miles
off. That's a good. There's the other side of wilderness, right? Yes.
We were talking about how there's several Lutheran camps around the country where you, a week or whatever. And I worked at Sky Ranch Lutheran camp, and that's very much, I mean, you can get down the mountain, but it takes 2 hours to get down the mountain. It's very curvy road. I got sick every time. type of thing. So there is no cell service there. And a lot of the camps either have a no cell policy or they have no service at all.
Yep. Yeah, so those of you who don't know, Sky Ranch outside of Fort Collins, Colorado would be the nearest sort of city that's there, right on the border of Rocky Mountain National Park. It's similar in the sense that you sort of look into federally designated wilderness in the same way that we do here, but nowhere near as isolated, so that would be kind of in the middle. A couple more.
Part of it for me was the journey here, because we come from Maine, and it was not easy. We didn't think about how to organize to get here, but the journey meant that the further you went, the more you were letting go.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's an important part of Holden, uh-huh. as much as I wish it was closer.
Right.
Inga? Well, similar to that, but it takes everyone a long time to get here. And just the 2-hour boat ride is a time for us to really let go of some of the distractions and the technology that we're always connected to. And I think that could be hard to... I mean, you could recreate a lot of other parts, but that's a big one.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've noticed when we come for the work weeks in the spring and fall, it's the fast boat is the only boat running, and it's only an hour, and I can't get out of civilization in an hour. It takes me that
So you want the slow boat going up here. It's interesting. I mean, so it is just thinking about, again, Paul Rohde's message last night, and it's partly sort of letting the river empty you along the way. And I do sort of challenge you to say, why can't the Root River or the Upper Iowa or the St. Croix or the Flambeau or something else or the Poudre empty us instead of it being Railroad Creek? Can't we voluntarily sort of find ways of traveling long distances that aren't physically long distances in order to do it? And I do think part of the reason I think about this is for somebody who lays awake at night thinking about climate change and fossil fuels, etc., the energy intensity of retreating to a place like this is something that I think all of us need to struggle with.
We're
but yet the
rationalizing our absence.
We are very good at rationalizing. We are the rational creatures, and we can rationalize most anything. But I think we may need to find ways of addressing how do we have the types of experiences that we have at Holden Village without the travel and the intensity that's involved in coming here. I mean, it's fascinating to think about it for Holden in terms of how do you negotiate the mine remediation, but there are bigger questions.
Yeah. Another question, when we go back, it's great to be here. How many of us have been to places like this? We go back, there's no support system, we're back to the old thing again. Mm-hmm. Has Holden done anything to try to create an alumni association, literally in various areas, to bring them together to carry some of this stuff on?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question, and I do think it gets us at part of the question that people have about wilderness as well, because it's not the same experience, but for somebody who has led youth in particular on backpacking or canoe trips into the wilderness, then how much of that is carried over into our lives again elsewhere? And I think that is a really important question to have in there. Yeah, Barb.
Isn't that the history of the labyrinth? People couldn't make the long journey to the Holy Lands, and so they created that.
Mm-hmm. You could create a place where you sort of physically, but also sort of metaphorically, you make a journey towards the center. I want to move on and do some more stuff with wilderness. It's an interesting question as we go through some of this, but there are other kind of big questions that are at work here as well from there. And I want to start just to make sure that we are understanding a little bit of what we mean by the idea of wilderness, etc. If I were to ask you, what is it that defines something as a wilderness? Or what are the characteristics that make something a wilderness from there? I mean, I think we've hit on some of them from there. We tend to think of it as a place that is isolated from civilization to varying degrees. But what else? What makes it a wilderness? What do you think of when you think of wilderness from there?
Unspoiled.
Unspoiled. Good. What else?
Quiet sounds.
Quiet.
But sounds. There are sounds, but they're quiet.
Okay.
Natural sounds.
Uh-huh. Since the absence of... And we'll get into this when we actually talk about the legislation, but there are legislation in terms of flyover of aircraft over even designated wilderness areas. So.
Undeveloped.
I heard another one in there too, I think.
I was going to say absence of commercial enterprises coming in, same thing, undeveloped.
Okay, yep, great.
Sustainability.
What are you thinking of in this case about, say a little bit more about how that fits in.
Kind of a closed system. Uh-huh.
So it's got that.
No waste.
It's natural.
Everything is food. Mm-hmm.
Great.
Well, I would, it may be this interpreted the same, but I would say lack of human intervention.
Uh-huh.
Which is not quite the same as developed, undeveloped.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Others? Other words that you think are descriptors that are important there? Say that particularly since it sits next to the lack of human intervention, what do you mean by preservation in this sense, or how does that fit in for you?
It's just the idea that it's going to be maintained
uh-huh.
in that state,
mm-hmm.
or you know, who knows how long.
Mm-hmm. In perpetuity is how we like to talk about it, sort of from there.
What about the whole ethical question of population explosion, expanding to this point where population is just going to override so many of these wilderness.
Mm-hmm. So limited access might be one of the things you want in there.
Sure. And in particular, we'll say this in a little bit more, is that roadlessness is one of the characteristics that's there, but in terms of the limited access, in particular, the absence of roads from there. I'll say more about this, but in some ways, the road that comes up from the lake up to here, wilderness advocates like to talk about cherry stem roads. So that you sometimes have an area where you have a road that comes in, but essentially the designated wilderness goes all the way around, and so that's the only thing that is there. That's the only place that isn't wilderness. Those of you who have been up, say, the Gunflint Trail, most of the area around that road in northern Minnesota is wilderness, except for that particular area that is in from here. If we look at the The wilderness as a land management designation dates to 1964, when Congress passed the 1964 Wilderness Act. It had been in process for decades before that, and coming on from there. But here's how they define a wilderness in terms of Congress defining it. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man, this is the 1960s, and his own works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. And I want to add one more on here because it's a word that sometimes gets a lot of discussion. They use the word untrammeled. And it's often misinterpreted as untrampled, as in an area that hasn't been sort of heavily, which is a little closer probably to unspoiled. But it's not quite the same. What is a trammel? Anybody know? I never had any idea until I started studying this stuff either. But it's a horse term, apparently, that a trammel is what you would put on the legs of a horse, at least one word for putting a rope, kind of hobbling a horse. In a sense, so it is constrained. So the horse can't run away, if you will. And so the idea behind this was to say that ultimately one with the wilderness is an area that is not controlled by humans, but is in that sense free. And that's a way of kind of describing a wild horse is an untrammeled horse. A wilderness area is an area that is not controlled by humans, as we go through it from there. I want to say just a little bit more about kind of the history of wilderness in the United States and then get into some other pieces of this along the way. Yes, sir?
On the national parks, one of the criteria was that it had absolutely no commercial value as land. Is there anything like that in the wilderness designation?
No. Part of understanding wilderness is that it's a designation that applies to lots of different types of ownership. So many of our national parks have some part of the park that is a designated wilderness, which has a different management sort of regime than others. But yeah, in the early days of the national parks, that they tended to look to areas that didn't have commercial development potential.
I mean, even timber and minerals, no potential for that.
Yep.
Yep,
and really in the earliest wilderness designation, a lot of it, the areas that were sort of put aside in that way were similar. And so there's a lot of talk about wilderness areas being primarily rock and ice. So you look up at the mountains above us here, and what do you see? A lot of exposed rock and a lot of snow and ice and glaciers and things like that. Well, I can't get much of anything out of that, so therefore I don't care that you lock it up from development. And in particular, we'll talk about arguments for wilderness in just a couple of minutes, that people who say the primary reason to preserve wilderness is for biodiversity. Most of our wilderness areas, compared to many other areas, have relatively low biodiversity. You know, the biodiversity in a swamp in southern Minnesota or southern Maine is much higher than the biodiversity in the 500,000 acres of the Glacier Peak Wilderness Area. We look out and we say, hey, this is beautiful. Look at that wonderfully diverse forest. Well, there's actually only 6 species of trees up there, whereas there are hundreds of species of plants in a prairie or thousands of species of plants in a marsh or a wetland from there. That the diversity is much greater oftentimes in the areas that we tend to think of as the least desirable. Those places that breed all those mosquitoes are wonderfully biodiverse areas. The beautiful peaks that we want to look up to oftentimes don't have that high of biodiversity, partly as a result of them being fairly harsh climates for us to get into in there. A little bit more about federal wilderness and then into some more questions related to some of this as we go forward from there. There is a difference between something, again, that we sort of think of as a wilderness area because it seems wild to us, and these kind of federally designated areas. I grew up on the edge of a small town in Iowa, and we spent lots of our time down the creek. We never called it a creek. It was always just down the creek, which was this little stream that ran between a couple cornfields, and to us, that was a wilderness. It was a very wild place that seemed set apart, seemed isolated, seemed uncontrolled by human beings from there. But with the designation of wilderness, it has to be a larger. It is in the legislation that you cannot designate a wilderness area that is less than 5,000 acres. But we have huge swaths of designated wilderness since the 1960s from there. So just to give you a little sense of that, of what they call the National Wilderness Preservation System, there are roughly 100 million acres of designated wilderness in the United States. Some of that is within our national parks. Some of that is within wildlife refuges, so from there. But the largest parts of that are within the U.S. Forest Service, our national forests, and also in land controlled by the Bureau of Land Management from there. So 30% of all of our public land in those four agencies is actually designated as wilderness. So a huge amount of our land is in that wilderness designation. What does that mean? It means no roads whatsoever. It means no wheels can be used in it whatsoever. When I lived in northern Minnesota, and sometimes in the spring when the ice, when the snow would melt, and you get this nice crust, we decided one day to take our bikes and go out riding across the lakes because it was frozen enough so you could actually ride your bike out 5 miles out across the lake and turn around and come back. The next day the Forest Service came back and we saw wheel tracks out on the ice from there. You cannot take your bicycle into the wilderness. It's against the law from there. If you see the signs out there, you can't take a hang glider into the wilderness. One time when I was up here, there was somebody who was an avid hang glider who was just really mad that they didn't let hang gliders into the wilderness from there. But it's very, very strictly controlled in terms of what can happen within those designated wilderness areas. Of that
Question.
Yes.
As I understand it, how was George Bush able to sign an executive order in his first term opening up wilderness areas of Utah to oil exploration?
Yeah, because... So the short answer is because they were not wilderness areas.
The news said it was wilderness areas, so maybe there wasn't, but that's what I heard in the news.
Yeah.
They
weren't designated as wilderness areas. And so there have been, going back to 1964, they designated a whole bunch of wilderness, and then there are various wilderness bills that designate wilderness at different times
so they
since then.
Official.
They were not officially designated wilderness. Okay. The two areas that have been at the heart of sort of fights over wilderness designation in the last 20 years have been Utah and Alaska. So if you're familiar with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge area, and some of those areas from there. But Utah in particular was a real focus for lots of wilderness advocates for a long time. And they had clearly studied all of these public lands, tried to determine the areas that had the necessary qualifications to become wilderness, and had introduced legislation every year to try to get things passed. So for a long time, you'd see bumper stickers in southern Utah that said 5.7 million acres. That's what they had determined, the wilderness advocates had determined, were the areas that qualified for federal wilderness designation but had not yet been designated. And so there was a lot of push for that. And there were many areas that were managed as de facto wilderness areas by the Forest Service or by the Bureau of Land Management. And in fact, that's the case of some of what's around here. So the Glacier Peak Wilderness Area is about 500,000 acres that surrounds much of Holden Village. But the area, if you go down the road and on the uphill side from there, that's part of the national forest like the wilderness area, but it is not officially in the wilderness until I believe the line is pretty close to that ridge, the extension of Martin's Ridge.
I'm glad you clarified that because I carried a grudge against that for a long time.
Well, it's, hang on to your grudge, but it's... But you can't, the executive order doesn't allow them to do that. And the history of environmental policy is very complicated, but one of the things that sort of is in there is presidents using executive orders to try to do things, particularly at the end of their terms, that they weren't able to do through Congress through the standard process. So Bill Clinton, in the last year of his presidency, did some really major stuff related to land preservation, and much of it was in Utah. Created a new national monument, or two new national monuments in southern Utah, but he just did it by executive order because they hadn't been successful through the legislative process. And then, sort of in the way of politics these days, then the other folks come in and say, no, I'm going to try to undo as much of what you did through that same sort of process. So studying and then trying to figure out how you can do that. What I was going to say about the area here is if you look at the National Forest Management Plan for this area, the area that is above or sort of up above the road between here and Chelan is say, we manage that as de facto wilderness. So the Forest Service has different management regimes in different places, and they manage this de facto wilderness. But it won't continue to be that way because they're going to put a big rock quarry in there, which they literally could not do if it was officially designated wilderness. But some areas are managed in more or less the same way.
Well, if it's an act of Congress, then they could do it, but that's not an easy thing to get.
That's right, yep. Yeah, so they can go back. Congress can go back and say, yeah, we said this once, but we've changed our mind and we could go back. I'm not aware that that has happened yet. Since 1964, I'm not sure that they have, in a sense, undesignated anything as wilderness from there.
Didn't they undesignate for the bridge in Stillwater?
So the National Wild and Scenic Rivers Act is a separate piece of legislation that does place restrictions on what you can do in various rivers depending on the designation that's there. And I don't know the details of that case, but I know that part of what they were looking at is how does that sort of fit into the legislation that's there. A lot more flexibility with the National Wild and Scenic Rivers Act than there is with the Wilderness
Act. Congress did have to pass a bill allowing that bridge.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Yep. Let me say just one other, let's move on. So I said 100 million acres. Over half of that is in the state of Alaska. So 54% of all of the designated wilderness in the United States is in Alaska. So huge, vast resources that are there, and that's where some of our wildest land is, and it's wonderful that it's preserved in that way. But as somebody once said about grizzly bears, when they say, well, at least they're in Alaska, to say, the problem is, what if you never get to Alaska, sort of in thinking about it from there. But there are wilderness areas in Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine. There was a very intentional effort to create some wilderness areas, much smaller in scale than that, and lots of them in the West in particular, as we think about it. The largest wilderness area is 9 million acres. Again, no roads, no mechanized transport, and very limited access along the way. What I want to do is shift us to thinking a little bit about why we should preserve wilderness and why some people think shouldn't be a priority. We talked a little bit yesterday about kind of anthropocentric versus non-anthropocentric reasons. And the sort of reasons for wilderness really do break down in the same way, that there are intentionally kind of human-focused reasons that primarily focus on recreation. Many of the earliest arguments for wilderness preservation were very much focused on providing opportunities for wild recreation, backpacking, canoeing, etc. If you think about certain areas, I don't necessarily want to run into an ATV if I'm out on a backpacking trip, and that is one of the pieces that's there. There has always been, in the rhetoric of wilderness, a sort of a spiritual dimension. We need areas that feed the human soul. And that's part of that sort of sense of isolation or a sense of being able to get solitude for humans in traveling into wilderness areas in terms of why we would do that from there. And thinking about, it's also a piece of, there is kind of an economic argument that's here. If you think about towns on the edges of wilderness areas, they often are very dependent upon serving those folks who are traveling into and out of those wilderness areas, whether to see them or not. There is then another set of reasons, which are really much more, less about us going there, and more about preservation, about biodiversity, as we said before. And there is this sense that, for some people, that what's most important is that we just have areas that we leave alone. That we, in a sense, never go there whatsoever. Part of what I wanted to sort of bring up is to say that there are sometimes tensions between these. Should all wilderness areas be open to humans? Or should we have areas where we simply say, nobody can go there? Should we have areas where we say, it's not about the backpacking or the canoeing that goes into there, it's simply about the preservation, and we should totally leave it alone? Should we preserve wilderness areas that have high biodiversity, but maybe very low recreational opportunities in terms of how we go about it from there? I want you to take just a couple of minutes and go back to the same group that you were talking about with from there. When you think about preserving wilderness, do you think about it in terms of the opportunities for humans, whether that's spiritual renewal or recreation, or do you think about it in terms of things that's not about us? And I think one way to think about it is, how would you feel about a wilderness area that was closed to all humans? Nobody was allowed into that area whatsoever. It was simply there on a preservation basis. Take 2 minutes back to your small group to talk about how do you see the reasons between these two from there, and then I want to take us into arguments. Let me have your attention back up here if we could. Looking at the time, I want to move us on, and we'll have time to sort of bring some of this out, and it provides it there, but I think some of the interesting stuff here is to look at some of the criticisms of wilderness. And what I'd like to do is to be able to lay some of this out for you and then be able to have a chance to talk about it together. And I think keeping in mind how we see the different positive pieces of it helps. But if we think of critics of wilderness and how that sort of fits us into this, it helps us understand, should we have more wilderness? Is this something that should be a priority? And there is, I think of it as a distinction between kind of a practical criticism versus a more conceptual one. And let me lay out the practical criticism first and then get into the conceptual stuff, because I think it's interesting for us. A lot of this very much focuses on locking up natural resources. Once an area is designated as wilderness, there can be no mining, there can be no logging, there can be no grazing, there can be no natural resources coming out of there whatsoever. And that even includes after a disaster or something like that, after forest fires or after other sorts of problems. There's lots of issues throughout the West right now with trees being killed by beetles and insects, and that leaves lots of standing dead trees. And so lots of people want to come in and do salvage logging. That you cannot do any sort of logging whatsoever in a designated wilderness area here. And so a lot of the folks, and a wilderness designation is meant to be in perpetuity, forever, so that you can't go into that. And related to this is the claim that ultimately wilderness designation is inconsistent with the principle of multiple use, which is what ultimately guides our public lands management. To have multiple uses. Yes, recreation should be one use, but only one compared to the others that are there. So oftentimes, whether that's George Bush or other critics of wilderness, it's to say, we need those natural resources to create jobs, to make sure that we have sufficient timber resources here, to make sure that we have sufficient mining resources, whether that's copper mines or others, so we shouldn't be sort of locking up those natural resources. 100 million acres that could be available for job creation that now you're just locking up and saying you can't even take your bicycle in there, let alone what's necessary to be able to take advantage of those wonderful resources that are there. Those trees are just rotting, whereas they could be being used for various human purposes from there. Reactions to that argument?
There's also an elitist charge that only, you know, the 1% that are in really good shape can get there. Mm-hmm. Us other 99% will never have a chance to see the interior of the wilderness.
Yeah, no, that's right. And to the extent it's recreation for elites, that it does tend to be overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly people of a certain social class that are ultimately taking advantage of wilderness recreation. Yeah. And therefore, it's not consistent with sort of the broad sweep of people.
Well, what about the question of population explosion? More and more people, are wilderness areas only going to be those places where human beings cannot exist, cannot live, have no resources? Where is that going to end in terms of?
By definition, wilderness areas are places where people cannot live. So whether Seattle has 3 million people or 10 million people in it, it's not an option for those people to get their resources or to find their homes within a federally designated wilderness area from there.
But that's by law. Practically speaking, they could create sustainable life within the wilderness areas.
No. This is essentially a wilderness area, but you'd have a lot of outside support.
It is an interesting question. I mean, so the idea of wilderness has tended to be a fairly American idea. And some people have tried very consciously to make it a global idea of having designated wilderness areas in other places. One of the things that happens is usually those attempts to designate wilderness areas or national parks that are managed as wilderness require the removal of people that are already living there. Not only not the expansion of more folks into those areas, but actually removing people from that. And that's part of the history of wilderness designation in the United States. You know, I keep coming back to the Boundary Waters because it is familiar to folks from the Midwest. It's also the most visited wilderness area in the United States. At the time that was created, they moved people out. They told folks that, I'm sorry, we've drawn the line here. Your lodge is on the wrong side of the line. You will have to relocate. We'll compensate you for your lost property, but it will be relocated along the way. And one of the concerns about it, particularly in places in Africa, I would say, is that you end up moving people out when you're designating areas for wildlife sanctuaries, etc., from there. I don't think the population per se is going to drive that. Population is in the process of leveling off. Yes, it's going to be a big deal to deal with 9 billion people instead of 7 billion people, but we crossed a couple years ago into the threshold that we have far more people that live in cities than that live in rural areas, and that increasing urbanization on a global scale is growing. I think the issue with population is going to be more, how do we deal with those areas surrounding cities that are continuing to grow, that have absolutely no potable water, have no sanitation systems, etc. I think the population pressure on cities will be a far bigger issue than the population pressure on the sort of natural areas. But ultimately solving those issues will be crucial from there. Let me push us into the next step of this, which is there's a whole other set of objections to wilderness, which I find really intriguing, coming from a variety of people. But perhaps the best known has been Michael Pollan. Those of you who know his work relating on food, the book The Omnivore's Dilemma, or In Defense of Food from there. An earlier book called Second Nature, Wilderness, or Pollan really raised some interesting questions about the concept of wilderness. And others have filed up in the same vein. And I want to just be able to touch on this. But the idea that bothers some folks is to say that if we hold up wilderness, if we say the place where nature is at its best, what we should strive for is to have areas of nature that by definition do not include human beings. Ultimately, don't we reinforce a separation between humans and nature? So the idea here is that what we're doing is we are reinforcing a human-nature divide. Let me try to draw this and then have a chance to talk about it just a little bit, and then I'll get into another piece of it in just a minute. So when we talk about wilderness, we said, and the way it's written is to say that's a place where human beings are not, where we're visitors. But ultimately, it's not controlled by humans, and humans cannot be in there. So we're saying, okay, here's nature out here. And yes, it's true that humans largely control large swaths of nature, but our goal ought to be to have more of nature that is in a condition that humans are not controlling. Doesn't that ultimately get at a notion that humans and nature are totally separate? And that for some folks, what we really need to see is that there is much more of, it's one thing, that there are areas maybe that are more civilized, there are areas that are more wild, humans fit in here, but ultimately, there is nothing that is outside of nature, including us, that we are fundamentally a part of the natural world. And that when we see areas, when we hold up areas as separate from humans, as kind of the highest ideal, and the claim is that the environmental movement has for decades sort of held up wilderness, held up areas separate from human beings as the highest ideal, that ultimately we reinforce that separation to say humans are out here and nature is out there, whereas ultimately we need to see something that sort of brings things together more than drawing them apart from there. And a related but slightly different objection is that ultimately we travel to the wilderness, we experience the beauty of nature, we go back home again, and we don't actually pay attention to what is around us from there. It's okay that we are, as long as we're preserving those wilderness areas, it doesn't really matter what's happening in my yard. It doesn't matter what's happening in the farm fields that ultimately supply the food to my body. It doesn't matter what's happening in the city from there, because we associate nature with out there, rather than sort of back here. And so the claim has come again that we tend to be more dismissive of everyday places because our association with nature is those beautiful places. It's the mountains that we see out the window, not the cornfield that is out my window when I go back home again. I can't wait to get back to Holden so I can get back to see nature, because I want to connect with God when I go to Holden. Meantime, the area that is outside my window is, in the words of some people, at least for those of us in the Midwest, an ecological sacrifice zone. It's a disaster in terms of how we understand our relationship to the nature.
It's better than the strip mall down the road.
Maybe. there. What do you think? Does that resonate? Therefore, people are saying, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have any wilderness, but we shouldn't focus on it. We shouldn't try to make it a priority to create more wilderness. Because ultimately we're sort of separating things out in a way that isn't healthy. And we need to find ways that bring humans and nature together. For Michael Pollan, it was gardens. He said, forget about wilderness preservation. Let's get more people working in the garden, where humans sort of are daily interacting with the natural world in a hands-on sort of way from there. And backpacking trips may be nice, but they may be counterproductive to the ultimate goal, which what we want, which is to more deeply embed humans in the natural world rather than to reemphasize that separation.
There is something to the getting your hands dirty in the dirt.
Yes.
You know? And I'm rural, but I'm going to be city. And I can appreciate both, but there is something about, and I'm in a wonderful valley, you know that, so I see the nature and things like that all around me all the time. But the city has it too, but it is mostly with the dirt.
I wonder how, actually Paul and I were discussing this, that we've got dune bug ears because we live at the ocean,
mm-hmm.
and we've got all these Barbosa and his friends come and they race around and race around, but they're not watching television at that time. And I mean, which is, it's
are
a
they
step.
Texting though at the same time?
I hope not. No, they're not, because there wouldn't have any Wi-Fi out there. But anyway, they are in nature. I would not want where I live to be filled with dune buggies. How do you control one person's idea of what they want for nature and what I want for nature, which is maybe a nice quiet walk on the beach?
Mm-hmm. I mean, one way that it's done practically is to designate different areas in different ways. And that's part of the idea behind wilderness designation, is to say, I don't want dune buggies, I don't want snowmobiles, I don't want four-wheelers. So there may be places for that, but there should be places where that isn't the case. And in our public lands, they do try to manage different areas in different ways to sort of make
that
possible.
And I guess, I've heard that when Niagara Falls was developed, that was the thing that you didn't want to be, and that's where the national parks came from, because you didn't want to end up looking like Niagara
mm-hmm.
Falls. Maybe it's capitalism, but we tend to do that sort of thing unless somebody says, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you stop? I mean...
yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think it's what's motivated a lot of the wilderness designations in the past.
Well, I think it goes back to the anthropocentric thing. I mean, I think that, too much of us think that, everything out there is for our benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all those resources that we're leaving out there in the wilderness area, well, we should have access to those, because gosh, we want more land and we want more people. And, but kind of in the last century, at least since Teddy Roosevelt and John Muir, we understand that when we screw with that, we're screwing with us, and we're screwing with the cities, and we're screwing with the birds and the flowers and the quality of the air and everything else. So I'm not so sure that we should allow that argument to continue, that, those resources, we need those resources for the growing population. We don't need a growing population. We need a more intelligent population. The nature versus human humans don't see themselves as part of nature. Mm-hmm. When they get their hands in the dirt, they realize, oh, I am connected. Mm-hmm. The rest of the time, their thumbs are on that little finger, their thumbs are on the horn, or their steering wheel. And at some point, I mean, we have to get beyond that to realize that, well, you know, it is the web. And I think the kind of the early part of the ecology movement, mm-hmm. like when I was young back in the 60s, it really was that we were all connected. It was much more of a like a native kind of a concept of that we are only a part of this web, and many times an insignificant part of this web. Mm-hmm. But now it's like it's more of the ecology movement has become more just another political school of thought.
Yeah, I think there's always been divides within the environmental or ecology movement. I mean, going back to John Muir and Gifford Pinchot and this sort of historic fight over what was happening in the Yosemite Valley. Should it be preserved or should it be, in this case it was a dam for water usage. How do we understand that sort of the role of humans related to other needs, sort of more anthropocentric ones from there? Yeah.
I make a distinction between the resources that are inside a wilderness area and the lessons that are within the wilderness area. And whereas you can take a trip in and come back out and not pick up any lessons, that's a matter of education that we can maybe do something about. Mm-hmm. Next time you go in, look for this. Mm-hmm. And if we take away the wilderness, we're taking away the lesson. Mm-hmm. Then what do we base what we do next on?
And those lessons may be a more valuable resource than the timber in terms of thinking about the future of things from there. We take just a couple more comments, then I want to make one more point before we run out of time.
I'm still trying to figure out what's going to happen in the future with the fact that we're getting so many animals to live with us now. You know, like for a while the eagle was almost extinct. Now in Minnesota we're getting so we have a lot of eagles. Mm-hmm. Canadian geese were gone. Now they're back in full force. Mm-hmm. So the turkeys are coming back.
We brought them back, yep.
They seem to be kind of really loving it around our field. Wherever. Arizona, I guess the coyotes are coming back.
Well, they're back everywhere. I mean,
we seem to be breaking up this human nature divide right where we live.
Well, I mean, I think what we're finding is that some animals are very well adapted to human civilization. And that includes pretty much everything that you just listed off. Others have a very difficult time sort of coexisting with our use of the land. So I don't know that we're necessarily seeing an across-the-board growth in wildlife. What we find is that some are really good at coexisting and some aren't. And
yeah, what does that mean, the fact that it's not across the board?
Different animals have different strategies for adapting, and some of those strategies are very consistent with our use of the land and some aren't.
So we need wilderness areas.
Yeah, I mean, so some of those animals won't make it without areas that are set aside from humans. But it doesn't mean we won't have wildlife. We'll just have deer and turkeys and geese and coyotes. And
yeah. Right. Civilization needs to learn to manage not only wilderness, but non-wilderness.
We're running out of time. I want to do one more thing that sort of relates to this that comes out for those that were here yesterday. Paul Rohde afterwards asked a great question, which is to say, all right, we're talking about anthropocentric versus non-anthropocentric. Shouldn't we be talking about a theocentric, a God-centered perspective? Ultimately, doesn't that sort of trump the bigger question? And I probably too quickly said, no, that it doesn't actually trump the bigger question. But I want to explain why, because I think it ultimately gets us at the heart of this issue about wilderness, but in a way that comes from a particularly Christian perspective. That if we say ultimately what we want is a theocentric, a God-centered perspective, we're still left with at least two different models of where we fit into that along the way. Historically, as at least a sort of dominant way of doing this within the Christian tradition, has seen God at the top, has seen humans here and has seen the rest of creation as in some sense below from there, that we occupy a position there. It's a fundamentally hierarchical model. God is at the top, at the center, if you will, and then we humans kind of fit in this way. And if you think about it from a metaphysical point of view, we actually have a foot in each realm, right? That we have a body, which is tied fundamentally to creation, but we also have a soul, which is reaching towards the non-physical, if you will, along the way. And this leaves us in a position to say that we humans can occupy a role as conquerors of creation, which historically we probably have done from there, or we can be stewards. That we can see ourselves as fundamentally in a role as caretakers of the rest of creation, of God's creation, because God is at the center, if you will. Or there is sort of another way of viewing this, because this is in some sense still a very anthropocentric view, which I don't mean to say that's wrong. I want to say that this sort of, the same question still comes back again from there. Or we can say that here is God, and here is all of God's creation, everything that God has made. And that certainly humans are a part of that, but so are other animals. So are plants, so are others, in a way, that places humans not above, but as fundamentally sort of a part of that, and that in the words that we are citizens, we are ecological citizens. I talked yesterday a little bit about Aldo Leopold, who said that we need to understand that humans are plain members and citizens of the biotic community, if you will. And that is the sort of non-anthropocentric. And in the context of wilderness, I think the concern of a lot of people is if we focus a lot on wilderness, if we focus on areas where we preserve nature, where humans are not a part of it, do we risk sort of reinforcing a view that separates out humans from the rest of it? I actually think the answer to that question is no, we don't. But it's, I think it's something that we really need to struggle with. And the preservation of nature should never be seen as a replacement for understanding how we fit into our places and how we make sure that we live responsibly where we are. And ultimately, it's far more important that we find ways of having small wild areas in every yard and on every farm and in every town. That we find ways of making sure that our interaction with the natural world every day, everywhere that we live, work, and play, is fundamentally a responsible interaction. That's far more important than that we have wilderness areas where we can sort of see the peaks or we can go on backpacking trips from there. And I think there is a danger that if we get ourselves focused on the nature that is away instead of the nature that is here, if we get ourselves focused on where it is that we go once a year to Holden Village or to Rocky Mountain National Park or to the Boundary Waters, that we risk losing that chance to say, what is it that I'm doing on a daily basis to connect myself to those lessons that can be learned there as well. But interesting questions about wilderness. Hopefully that it feeds some of your thinking as you go into lunch and fresh your bodies as well. So thanks for coming. I appreciate your time.